Roxy, last week you made me give my bio data for our matchmaking episode, but we actually never got your bio data.
You don't need it. I've got my bio data match.
I still think John, your fiance, should know what he's getting into. So, quick, what's your zodiac sign?
I'm a Pisces, fish, water symbol.
What does it mean?
I think it's like a lot of like watery things, like moody, a lot going on under the surface.
Shallow. No, just kidding.
Sometimes shallow.
The water thing can go, you know, there's different levels.
There's can go either way. Fluid, flexible.
That makes sense. Boxers or briefs?
Oh, boxer brief, anyone?
This seems to be a popular opinion.
That seems best.
From Religion News Service, this is Saved by the City, a podcast from two Christian women achieving big achievements and feeling big feelings in the city that never sleeps. I'm Caitlin Beatty.
And I'm Roxy Stone.
I'm Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. This week on The State of Belief, Jim Wallace, founder of Sojourners and author of the new book, The False White Gospel, Rejecting Christian Nationalism, Reclaiming True Faith, and Refounding Democracy.
It's a culmination, summation of the work that a lot of us have done for an awful long time. I think the time has come for a serious test of faith.
The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet. Distributed by Religion News Service Podcasts and available on your favorite podcast app. I'm Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. The State of Belief is a weekly podcast with a potent mix of spiritual wisdom, political strategy, and hopeful commentary. In a series of inspiring conversations, celebrating our diversity, and bringing us together to, in the words of the great James Baldwin, achieve our country. The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet. Distributed by Religion News Service Podcasts and available on your favorite podcast app.
Caitlin, I feel like we have a lot to talk about. And by that, I mean there's been a lot going on in specifically the world of religion and news. And in particular, evangelicalism and news.
Where to start?
Exactly. Where to start?
Well, I came across a piece that I really wanted to hear your thoughts on.
Okay.
It's from Ruth Graham, a reporter for the New York Times, titled Piety and Profanity, The Raunchy Christians Are
Yes,
Here.
I saw this.
So basically, there is this calendar, like a pinup calendar, swimsuit calendar, called The Conservative Dads, Real Women of America. And the reporting was on like the number of influencers who are posing for the calendar who are also self-identified Christians, and like their evangelical Christianity is part of their public brand. And there was basically two camps that responded to this. One was more conservative Christians who were like, this is so inappropriate. You know, Christian women shouldn't be doing this. Mm-hmm. And another group that basically praised the calendar for being anti-woke. There's like a weird, like, we're going to be crass to own the libs, which is just a totally bizarre.
Well, because respecting women for more than their bodies is woke.
I mean, is that where we are? Like, honestly, is where we are, like, objectifying women is like a Republican thing?
Own the libs. Tyler Huckabee, our good friend, also recently wrote about this in a slightly different context, but he wrote about how there's this weird conservative obsession with Sydney Sweeney, the actress.
Yes.
And specifically with her boobs.
Ample bosom.
Yes.
That was all my mom. I'm channeling the essence of E. Karen Beatty when I said ample bosom.
Apparently having a full rack.
How many ways can we come up with to talk about having large breasts?
Apparently a conservative thing to own or want. So it's woke to have small boobs. I don't know. I don't totally get it. But it's like that's what a real American woman is. That's what a real red-blooded man wants.
Yes. I think that's really key. There's a kind of trumpeting of male libido and going for a very traditionally feminine version of beauty and sex or sexiness. That's like rejecting, well, needless to say, all the women in this conservative dad's Real Women of America calendar are white. So there's very much a rejection of like diversity for diversity's sake.
Which is what they would call it. Yeah.
And you don't have to scratch far below the surface to just find like white Christian nationalism or white nationalism, right? Like what it means to be American is to like white women. But also a rejection of the body positivity movement. Like you'll see this flare up on Twitter from time to time where some MAGA type male influencer will post a photo of like a woman in a bikini with large breasts and be like, this is what real beauty is. And then post a photo of someone else that's like, why do we think this is? It's honestly just so gross.
Right. It's hard to talk about. It's so gross. As a woman, it's pretty frustrating that moving away from what was a very toxic and dangerous idea of what the female body should look like, i.e. very, very skinny. Like we've moved away from that. As women, as a society, we're trying to say, here's what normal bodies look like. And of all the places where you would think there'd be some praise for that, it would be like in a church that you think is supposed to be like accepting of people.
Yeah, the connection to the Christian influencers who are featured in this calendar, it kind of made me think of the smoke and hot wives phenomenon.
Yeah, right.
Like a kind of culturally conservative, like we're not prudes.
Right.
You know, Christians can be hot. Christians can have a great sex life. Christians are blah, blah, blah.
Right.
We're not being prudish. We're embracing our sexuality, but like also for Jesus.
It's so weird.
One of the women featured in the calendar is a Catholic influencer, and she's shown in like a kitchen setting, but scantily clad with, it's a short apron. She's holding some kind of dish. There's a cross in the background, and she's wearing those, like, in my opinion, very tacky heels that are super high, but then have like the big chunk at the bottom.
Like a platform heel?
Yes, they're heels that you wear as if you're on a platform. Anyway, she commented on this photo and was like, I don't care if the fact that I look hot doing any of these traditional feminine things in the kitchen offends your senses. And you're like, what? You like pray the rosary?
I mean, who was it offending?
Well, there was all this backlash to the calendar by some conservative Christian.
Oh, I see.
There was a portion of conservatives saying, like, this is inappropriate. This is too far. This is really distasteful. It feels very MAGA. You know, it feels like conservative politics has totally been taken over by, like, the crassness of the person of Donald Trump.
Who, of course, was a television star. And so much of this, like, also comes back to, like, these ideas of what beauty is that Hollywood has. But how did we get from modest is hottest to sexy is hottest? Like, how do we like square that circle?
Yeah. I know you've mentioned before the wives of megachurch pastors.
Oh my gosh, and their Instagram accounts.
And their Instagram profiles that are a very strange combination of like personal piety or, you know, family photos, like really emphasizing prayer and family. And then also photos of them like at the club in like skin tight leather pants and lots of cleavage. And there doesn't seem to be any disconnect for them. They're obviously trying to communicate something. I think it might be like, I want you to know that I am hot. And my husband is hot and we have a great sex life. I think there's some kind of image management around that.
Right. Like you said earlier, like Christians don't have to be prudes. Our lives are not boring and rigid and legalistic. Look, we can have fun too. It can be cool to be a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Also, maybe a little prosperity gospel thrown in there of like, I have favor because I'm beautiful.
Oh, weird. I have never thought about the prosperity gospel as pertaining to like your natural beauty or looks. But that is fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, you could buy some of that too.
Oh, well, yes. Like your physical beauty is a sign of God's favor.
Right. Or your wife's physical beauty is a sign of God's favor for you as a husband.
That feels absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
This is a zig. There was so much PDA in my church this last weekend.
Oh, remember that one time you wrote about how annoyed you were by couples who like scratched each other's back during worship?
This is unfortunate because I'm also writing about this right now, so maybe I've already said my piece.
I think it was a tweet years ago, and I was just like, oh, Kayla doesn't like that. Okay.
Am I just being like sour grapes? Like, how do you feel when you see various like rubbing and touching between couples at church?
Yeah, I think there's a moment where I get annoyed with it. I can handle a certain amount of it, but I have sat in church with my fiance in past months and like have thought about you and that tweet like it's like, but not, no, but it's a good thing to be aware of. I do think there's something about just like sitting there for a while that you're just like
You're just like bored and you're like sitting next to each other.
How often do you just kind of sit next to each other for like an hour like that or something, but outside of like a movie or whatever? So
right, it feels to me like opinions on this topic are pretty clearly divided between couples and
single
people.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously different couples have different levels of like what they're comfortable with. Like, I can't imagine my parents rubbing each other's backs or something in church. Oh, there's this older couple at my church that sit in the front center row and they kiss throughout the service.
Whoa.
And I know that sounds like exaggeration, but like multiple times in the service they will turn to each other and like embrace and kiss.
Do you think they listen to this podcast?
I don't think they do. I don't think they do. And if you are listening, the Lord bless your romantic love. I'm so happy for you.
All right, so back to the MAGA world taking over evangelicalism. This is one of the things I wanted to talk about. Did you see Trump's Bible?
Yes.
As in the Bible that Trump was shilling, not his actual Bible, although he swears he owns multiple of them because it is his favorite book.
Yes, he's a big fan of 2 Corinthians.
Mm-hmm.
I did see the announcement over Easter weekend. I saw that it includes copies of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights and the Pledge of Allegiance.
And also the lyrics to God Bless America, written by Lee Greenwood. It is actually, I think, a Bible produced by Greenwood, although I need to go back and look.
It just kind of feels at this point like maybe we're getting trolled.
Yes, absolutely, 100%.
Like, what's the most ridiculous, overtly Christian nationalist thing that Trump could do 6 months before the election? Start selling Trump Bibles for $60.
$60.
I just don't understand why anybody would want like a compilation of all the important documents from American history.
It's obviously like a leather-bound Bible, but it has the American flag sort of stamped on the front of it. Also, one of my favorite things about the God Bless America Bible that just feels really ironic to me is that it's the King James Version, as in the King of England, who America fought a battle to secede from.
That's hilarious.
One of the reasons was for the separation of church and state.
That is wild. It's also not the easiest Bible translation to read.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's not like a populist Bible, which is sort of like the whole point of Trumpism, right?
Right. I think it's fair to say that the Trump Bible is meant to be for like a populist audience, but the KJV translation is like pretty arcane and antiquated language.
I mean, to be fair, they use the KJV because it is public domain.
That explains a lot.
I still think it's funny. I still think it's ironic.
Yeah. There are a lot of Bible versions and translations out there to choose from. So I have a pop quiz for you.
Okay.
Great. There are some very, I will say, culturally specific Bibles out there, and I have three questions for you about them. Here we go. Question number one, which language from the world of nerds, and I say nerds lovingly, has received its own Bible translation? A, Klingon. B, Elvish, Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. Or three, Na'vi from...
The Blue Man, the Blue Movie.
Yeah,
the movie where the people are blue. Avatar.
Yes.
I'm going to go with Elvin.
It is actually all of the above.
Of course it is!
But Elvish, that's the one I see the most appeal in. Like, if you're a hardcore Lord of the Rings person, I totally get it. Okay, that was very good. Number two, so Thomas Jefferson somewhat infamously published his own Bible that omitted all reference to miracles and right. the divinity of Jesus. It came out in 1820. It was 84 pages long. How did Jefferson make his Bible? A, he used his horse's hair to stitch pages together. B, he used a razor and glue. Or C, he used his wife's then new technology, the sewing machine.
Oh, C, the sewing machine.
He used razor and glue.
Dang, you really crafted that last one well. It was the then new machine that got me. I was like, oh, that's such a good historical detail. Ooh, you trickster.
That's kind of the fun of doing the pop quizzes. Okay, final question. What Bible translation of Luke 1 is the following from? Mm-hmm. Mary was a pick-me girl for God and was simping for him in prayer when Gabriel appeared to her and said, "Ayo, you're a real one and the top G is feeling you." But she thought his compliment was low-key sus and gave him the side eye.
Oh my gosh. I don't know, like some person's idea of what Gen Z talks like.
Yes. It's the Gen Z Bible.
Period. No cap. Yeah. Those are the two things I just learned recently. The two Gen Z phrases my friend just told me about.
Okay, good job on the quiz. Before we get to our guest for today, I wanted to hear what's making you happy so far in 2024.
Our annual conference is coming up, the Religion News Association Conference in Pittsburgh this year. And I always love that. I really look forward to it. It's a lot of super interesting panels and just getting to like talk to people who are in the same industry and covering some of these same issues. And this year you will be there also, which is fun.
And we're planning a little podcast live thing. But we can't talk about it right now.
Get excited. What about you? Fun work stuff? Cool work stuff?
Yeah. Well, before I head to the RNA conference in a couple weeks, I will be in Grand Rapids, Michigan for the Festival of Faith and Writing.
Oh, yay.
At Calvin University.
I bet some of our listeners will be there too.
Yes. Come say hi. There will be a Brazos press booth. I can't promise you that we're going to publish your book, but I'm willing to have a conversation with you. Yeah, so I have gone every year that it has been held since I was a sophomore in college.
Wow.
So I feel like it's one of my favorite gatherings and just a really fun time to see friends and peers and to hear some great writers speak about the craft of writing. And I also know our podcast guest today will be there in part to celebrate
Yay.
Her new book. I edit, you know, so many books in a given year. I'm not supposed to have favorites. Mm-hmm. But Micah Boyette's new book, Blessed Are the Rest of Us, is truly one of the most beautifully rendered books I've gotten to work on recently. And so it's no surprise that our conversation with her was also beautiful.
When you love someone who the world is sorry that they exist or that they've been given to you, it feels like...
Micah also goes to my church, so it was fun for me to get to have her on the podcast as well. So we will hear from Micah later in the show, but first...
It's time to give a shout out to the organization that makes this all possible.
Religion News Service is an independent, award-winning source of global reporting on religion, spirituality, culture, and ethics.
From synods to shamans to Super Soul Sunday, Religion News Service is the best site to get news from across the spiritual spectrum.
Our listeners should know that Saved by the City has some podcast company. Religion News Service now has a podcast network. It includes Martini Judaism with Rabbi Jeffrey Salkin and The State of Belief with Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. Give them a listen.
We'd also love to hear your feedback and ideas as we round out season 7 of Saved by the City. Drop us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts or shoot us an email at sbtcpodcasts@religionnews.com.
Hey there, curious minds.
Get ready to embark on a unique journey at the crossroads of money and religion with our new podcast, Money Meet Meaning.
The seductive effect of money, we think it can do the work that God does because there's something about money that does that. It's wild.
I'm Amber Hacker.
And I'm Tom Levinson.
Tune in for a blend of wisdom and levity as we decode the path to a more meaningful relationship with money.
I think giving, and this is a little crass, but I feel like it's the ultimate middle finger to money. It's liberating to give some away.
This podcast is your gateway to a vibrant and thought-provoking exploration of the interconnectedness of wealth and spirituality.
Join us as we unravel the surprising influence of ancient wisdom on modern finances.
Faith pervades people's lives and our society. And because money is such an important part of people's lives, exploring that intersection of faith and money, I think, is super, super interesting.
Get ready to be informed, entertained, and inspired to transform your financial outlook with Money Meet Meaning. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
We're really pleased today to be joined by friend of the podcast and author of the new book, Blessed Are the Rest of Us, Micah Boyette. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey.
Hey. It's fun to see you outside of church.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm so excited to be here. I'm a every weeker in terms of my listening to Saved by the City.
Oh.
Yeah. There's like those podcasts that I kind of check to see what it's about before I listen. Mm-hmm. But you guys, it's every week.
Oh my gosh.
That feels great.
Well, we can just end the conversation there. I mean,
if you need me to come back for an ad, you know, I'll do it.
Thank you.
We would love that. So your new book, Micah, is about, it's about a lot of things, but one of the main questions that it centers on is what it means to be blessed or to receive blessing. And you write about this, that the word blessed is like a Christianese word that makes me cringe. Like whenever anybody says like, I feel blessed or I am blessed, I'm like, no, you're not.
Hashtag blessed.
Yep.
Yes, all of that. We know the phenomenon.
Yes, yes.
How have you come to understand what blessing actually means or means in this deeper way that centers on the Sermon on the Mount and the story of the kingdom of God?
I think I stopped using the word blessing or blessed maybe like 15 years ago. So the fact that it's in the title of my book still kind of gives me the heebie-jeebies. So, but I am really interested in what it means because I am so drawn to the Beatitudes, which is what I focus this book on. I started to come to the Beatitudes early on after my son was born. My youngest son was born with Down syndrome, and later he was diagnosed with autism, and he's non-speaking. And as I've kind of lived this journey with him, I found so much direction, and I think I needed language for who my son Ace is to me, but also his value in the world. Mm. And the reason that I just kept coming back and back to the Beatitudes was not because I was like, I'm blessed, and ACE is blessed in the sense of the way that we use it, the way that the barista uses it when they tell you to have a blessed day, which doesn't happen as much in New York City.
That's true. Exactly.
But man, you go south of the Mason-Dixon line and you're getting blessed days everywhere. Mm-hmm. But I found myself in the world with this child who everywhere I went with him, even as a baby, he was stared at. Mm-hmm. I was pitied. Mm-hmm. I had this brand new baby, and I felt like people felt the need to say they were sorry to me. Mm. And when you love someone who the world is sorry that they exist or that they've been given to you, it feels like everything is wrong. Mm. Whatever we think it means to be human, we're all getting it wrong here. Mm-hmm. Mm. So for me, it started with redefining what it means to be human. And I think for me, I started to see in myself that my definitions of being human had everything to do with what I was capable of doing. What made me good at being a person was like what I could accomplish and what people thought of me and how I performed in the world, you know, from all the way back to being the super A+ like girl of the year or whatever.
We don't relate to that at all.
Yeah, I'm sure you don't. But like as I started to redefine what it means to be human, which the definition that I kept coming back to over and over is that we are human because we're capable of giving and receiving love. Mm. And to give and receive love is to embrace vulnerability. And I started to see in me that that was not how I was experiencing humanity. I was valuing myself by how close I was to being a machine. Mm. And as I came to the Beatitudes, I found Jesus saying, here's how to be a human. And it was about vulnerability. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I came to one scholar's work, Jonathan Pennington. He has a book called The Sermon on the Mount and Human Flourishing. And he's talking about how the word that is originally in the Greek, we translate as blessed, but what it's really talking about is this recipe for happiness or what it means to have a whole and flourishing life. And he gets that idea from the fact that Jesus is kind of copying this Greco-Roman oratory device that these Greco-Roman like virtue poets would stand up and speak to the people and tell them, I'm going to tell you how to have a happy and flourishing life. And usually then they would list these virtues like, you know, keep your word and be a hard worker, you know, like those sort of things. And Jesus takes this device. He's standing there early on in his ministry before the longest recorded sermon he gives. And he says, I'm going to tell you how to have a whole and flourishing life. Mm-hmm. And you, people, are becoming whole when you're impoverished. And you're becoming whole when you're grieving. And you're becoming whole when you are releasing your power and embracing meekness. And when you are leaning into peacemaking and working against injustice in the world. And so it stops being this transactional idea of like, we do this good thing and then we get good stuff, or like, I'm so blessed I'm in Hawaii, or like, look, my children are perfect and beautiful and make straight A's, hashtag blessed. And instead, it is this upside down, just like Jesus always does, saying, if you want to be whole, I am inviting you to a kind of wholeness that is found in your weaknesses, in your longings, in your limits.
Mm-hmm. Can you give some examples of that that aren't a sense of, I don't know, like martyrdom or something? Mm. It's not transactional, but I think there's like a little bit of a lesson in sometimes in evangelicalism that I've absorbed that's like the suffering has this point of making you a stronger person. How do you sort of wrestle with that idea that this might not just be like a means to an end?
I mean, I think this is part of why I wanted to wrestle with the Beatitudes, is that it does feel tricky to me in that way. Mm-hmm. Along the way, one of the things I read that I loved the most was something Gregory Boyle said, that the Beatitudes are not a spirituality, but a geography that tells us where to stand. And I really love that idea. Jesus said he was bringing a kingdom. And the way that I like to think about that is like that he was making God's dream a reality. I got those words from Stephanie Spellers. And there's something in between and mysterious whenever we talk about the kingdom of God, but this idea of like Jesus was bringing God's dream, making it real. And what does it mean for it to be real in our lives? And what does it mean for the Beatitudes to be a place where we stand and not something that we are working on? I think to go back to your question, Roxy, I don't want to stand here and be like, my son is an inspiration, because I think that that is kind of this ableistic narrative that is propelled, that's like, oh, these sweet people with intellectual disability here to inspire us all, or they're part angel. And that's also like the way blessing was used for me a lot when my son was a baby or little, was like, oh, what a blessing he is for your family, which I think that's intended from a good heart most of the time. But it also kind of takes this idea of like he exists for us and not for himself and his own humanity. But I do think that there has been transformation for me in the way that I have experienced his life and the longing that I've felt. There are things that are just really hard for him. And I want life to be easier for him. And I mean, the biggest grief for me in his life is that he doesn't speak. He was sick this week. He had a stomach bug. And man, I want him to be able to tell me like when it hurts and when it doesn't hurt, when he's starting to feel better. And there's so many ways that when we can't speak, and he's learning to communicate in other ways, but that we can't fully let ourselves be known. And that's an ache and a longing for me.
Talk a little bit about this beautiful phrase that you are borrowing from Stephanie Spellers, the dream of God. What is the dream of God? What does it look like? And why is that a better or a more compelling phrase for you than something like the kingdom of God?
I mean, I think you can see the kingdom of God as being problematic for different reasons. First of all, we don't really live in a kingdom, and so we don't really understand how that works besides like our obsession with royalty here in America. But the idea of what kingdom meant when Jesus was using that phrase with the people who were listening to him when he gave his Sermon on the Mount, they were understanding kingdom as like the center of their worlds. The decisions that the people in charge made trickled down to them, and usually it was oppressive. And so Jesus was inviting them to a reimagination, that I want you to picture where the people in charge are good. What is going to trickle down from this kingdom is going to be for what is flourishing for you. It's going to be for peace. It's going to be for joy. It's going to be for real life. I think the dream of God gets at the same thing. There is an intention in the heart of God for what humanity could be and what creation could be as a whole. And when we believe that God is making all things new, that God is redeeming and restoring the world, then we can start to reimagine like what it means that God is moving towards this dream that is in God's heart, that is the longing God has for us.
The dream language is really compelling because it suggests that God has longings. God is not static, kind of removed and carrying out some kind of plan according to God's purposes. Like God has desires for us specifically.
And desires for the restoration of the world. It can be so crushing to just tune in to the world. You know, like I was listening to y'all's conversation about this political moment. I mean, how much you just want to turn off the news and just hide. And I don't know, I find so much peace in the idea that God has a dream and that I am invited to be part of it. And in that dream, there is going to be restoration. There's going to be joy. There's going to be comfort for all those who are suffering, that injustice is going to be done with, and to just keep living in that kind of hope. Mm-hmm. And I think that too, like to bring it back to what Gregory Boyle said, like the Beatitudes tell us where to stand, their geography.
You know, you sort of made reference to some of the less than awesome reactions you got to Ace's presence in your life. You mentioned in your book that shortly after he was born, an acquaintance asked, what made you decide to keep him? Which is like hard to even say. Mm-hmm. But how have you responded to some of those sort of false narratives about human value and worth that you've gotten in relation to Ace? And maybe that you mentioned before that they've even affected how you view yourself.
When that acquaintance said that to me, what made you decide to keep him? I was so taken aback that I just sort of had this reaction of, we wanted him. But I think Ace's presence in my life has revealed to me the depth of ableism in our culture and how really our society is built on structures of ableism. That's why we are a hustle culture. That's why we value people with power, and we value people who are efficient, and our technology is just keeps speeding us up because we're building technology that will overcome our vulnerabilities. It's interesting. I was listening to a podcast yesterday, and a really smart woman was on talking about being human in an age of technology, something like that. And the question she was asked towards the end was, if you could change anything genetically to make humanity better, what would you change? And I was very surprised because she brought up this recent article about how in Denmark, there are basically not any children being born with Down syndrome because every woman is given prenatal testing. And there is a cultural assumption that if a child is diagnosed to have Down syndrome, that that pregnancy is terminated. And she brought it up as like, this is complicated for me. And the host was like, yeah, it's complicated for me too. And I could tell the way they were talking about it, they didn't really have a connection to Down syndrome. And they were just, they were trying to be thoughtful about it. But the woman, as a way to kind of continue the conversation and to say, I don't know if we should change anything genetically in humanity, she said, you know, the things that I don't like about myself actually are really important to who I am. And that was kind of the point she was making. But as the mom of Ace, I heard like here's Down syndrome, here's the things I don't like about myself. And that is an undercurrent in our culture that of course those two things would go together. Of course, this is like an example of this other thing where like an undesirable thing that has still, doggone it, has taught me some stuff.
Right.
I think the challenge that I face in trying to talk about my experience with Down syndrome, like the narrative that I want to give the world is not like Ace's life is easy, and it's also not Ace's life is so hard. I want it to be like Ace is valuable and we need him. That Ace's limits are real, just the same as my limits are real. And they look different from each other. But that's not where my value comes from. My value doesn't come from what I can do. And neither does Ace's. Like the transformation of the way we think about what makes us good.
I was thinking as you were talking about this about your some other work that you do, including a podcast, The Slow Way. am just sort of wondering like what the overlap is with that. I mean, some of what you're talking about is just like this drive as humans to be like this level of efficient mm-hmm. and ignore our limitations. And I'm wondering if there are some ways that this journey has led you to this valuing of like taking more time and being slower. Is there like an additional Micah beatitude of like, blessed are the slow, because.
Yeah, there is. 10 years ago, I wrote a book, and it's the only other book that I've written. And it came out like this month, 10 years ago. And I had a 2-book deal, and I was supposed to write my second book like within the next couple of years. But first I got pregnant and I was like, I'll just have this baby and then I'm going to write a book about rest. So I was already interested in like slowing down and what rest is supposed to mean and all of that. And then I had this baby that required so much of me. Mm-hmm. And it was a really intense season in my life. And I ultimately was like, I can't write this book on rest. Instead, I was forced into this life of living with smallness, you know, taking Ace to the doctor and taking Ace to therapy and watching him slowly learn how to build his muscles so he could crawl and cheering him on when we had, y'all, he had this old man metal walker when he was 2, just walking with the walker, and everything just took longer. Mm-hmm. And I realized over time that I was being reformed. Instead of it being this outward thing of like 10 ways we're going to learn how to rest, mm-hmm. it was like I needed to learn how to live slow. Like that was my way towards rest. And in the slowness, I was able to really start to embody all the things that I'd been wanting to understand, you know, prayer and spiritual practices and the contemplative life. Ace was an invitation for me into like bringing those things into my body.
In the slowness that like your then new life with Ace was requiring of you, I imagine you didn't like it. Or there was something in you that really resisted what invitation you were receiving, not because of Ace, but because of how all of us have been shaped to value efficiency and productivity and getting as much done in a day as you can. And if I'm getting impatient in the grocery store line from a mild inconvenience, I just imagine there's a kind of relinquishing and that mm-hmm. the relinquishing could be painful.
Yeah. There were a lot of tears shed over that second book that didn't get written. There was a lot of shame for me. I think I had built my idea of myself. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to be the person, and I know y'all understand this, who people say, I just don't know how you do it. Mm-hmm. And even when my first book was written and I had 2 little kids, you know, they were like kindergarten and 3, I just, you know, swelled with that kind of praise. Like, mm-hmm. how do you fit it all in? Well, mm-hmm. I don't really sleep, but I'm not going to tell you that, you know?
I'm just blessed.
I'm just blessed.
God has given me so much energy to do the work he's given me to do.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. I remember having a conversation with someone who was telling me that they had stopped working to get their kid to all the therapy and all the doctor's appointments. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay. I'm just thinking about it this way. Like, it's not that I, you know, failed this contract. It's not that I'll never have a career again. I just stopped working for a little bit. And actually, this is kind of funny. I mean, funny now, maybe. I had when Ace was in preschool on the first day of school, when he was 4, everybody held up their little signs that, you know, all the cool moms make their kids do of the picture before the first day of school and what grade they're in. And then I held up a sign that was like, first day of writing my next book.
Aww.
Ace is about to turn 9. So this is like 5 years ago. And I worked on my next book for about 2 or 3 weeks. And then Ace and I fell down some stairs together when I picked him up from school. Mm-hmm. And I had a major concussion and had post-concussion syndrome for a long time and didn't heal. And it took me a couple of years to be able to like get back to the place just where I could focus and write again. So it was just like a long journey. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. each part of that journey was painful, and it was changing my internal structure, you know? Mm-hmm, I still struggle with the am I doing enough? Am I working hard enough? But I think I have a much stronger voice that pushes back on that than I used to. Mm-hmm.
To be blessed, according to the Sermon on the Mount, is things that a lot of us might, as Caitlin said, kind of might resist, that don't feel like blessings for us, mm-hmm. like meekness, vulnerability. Like, these are not traditional American values. So what are some daily ways, some daily practices that you recommend to help press into this dream of God in our own mm-hmm. personal lives?
And I have a podcast too, and each one of them has a slow practice, which is kind of rethinking spiritual practices. Prayer, as most of us have been taught, especially those of us who grew up in evangelical spaces, prayer is supposed to be us saying stuff, and mm-hmm. rarely are we taught how to listen, how to receive from the presence of God, how to discern. I think some of the gift of just thinking about slowness as a value is it gives us more permission to sit and receive.
In terms of like a practical practice,
there's an image I have that I got from Richard Rohr, where he talks about how we often live on the surface of our lives, mm-hmm. you know, our performance at work, our to-do lists, the things that we have to kind of make our way through, and then also how we present ourselves to the world. And when we talk about vulnerability, that is living in this core space inside us. So I've done this imaginative prayer practice with this workshop that I lead, where I invite people to sit and just reflect on their limits in their life. For me, the first thing that comes to mind is that since I had this fall and had these concussions, I have chronic migraines. That mm-hmm. feels like a major limit in my life, where I just am forced to either be in bed or medicate. Mm-hmm. And so I might write that down, or I might write down the ways that time is working in my life, and I just don't feel like I have the time to pursue these other things, or financial limits, or psychological limits, or physical limits, all these different things that are true in my life, and maybe even spiritual, moral limits, ways that I feel like I'm mm-hmm. failing. Mm-hmm. And then I also have people write down their longings and the things that they wish they could change, the things that they are aching over, whether that is longings in the greater world, longings in their own lives. And then, you know, I have them draw this big circle and then this tiny circle in the middle to start to see each of those limits and those longings as arrows that are pointing towards this core part, and to see them all as invitations to be moving away from this kind of pretense life mm-hmm. to this core space, the kind of space that Jesus is inviting us to. And just to have that visual image of these are the things that are drawing me into a different way of being mm-hmm. and even into the dream of God.
Thank you so much, Micah, for joining us and talking to us today. I appreciate it.
Yes, and congratulations on your new book.
Thanks, ladies. It's been really good to be with you.
Saved by the City is a Religion News Service production. The producer is Jay Woodward, and the consulting editor is Paul O'Donnell. We get production assistance from Julia Windham.
Chaz Rousseau put together our look, and Martin Fowler wrote our theme music.
We are Roxy Stone.
And Caitlin Beatty.
Thanks for listening. Own the libs with puffy lips.
Okay.